This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we'll be looking at the Republican National Convention. We'll be speaking with David Swanson about the transformation of the Republican Party into a war-making one from its pacifist roots, believe it or not, in the 1920s. Also today, we'll be speaking with Ivan Eland of the Independent Institute about the role of Ron Paul in the Republican Party. That and more. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And today we consider, on this opening day of the Republican National Convention in Tampa, Florida, the history of the party and its transformation into a much more internationally belligerent party. In the 1920s, there was a president who continued the tradition of the reduction of government spending and taxing, but he also was a mover and shaker in an international peace movement that would renounce the use of war as a tool of foreign policy. That president was Calvin Coolidge.
I believe in the American Constitution. I favor the American system of individual enterprise, and I am opposed to any general extension of government ownership and control. I believe not only in advocating economy in public expenditure, but in its practical application and actual accomplishment. I believe in a reduction and reform of taxation, and shall continue my efforts in that direction. I am in favor of protection. I believe in the permanent court and further limitation of armaments. I am opposed to aggressive war. I shall avoid involving ourselves in the political controversies of Europe, but I shall do what I can to encourage American citizens and resources to assist in restoring Europe with the sympathetic support of our government. I want agriculture and industry on a sound basis of prosperity and equality. I shall continue to strive for the economic, moral, and spiritual welfare of my country. The laws of the land are being and will continue to be enforced.
President Calvin Coolidge speaking in 1924. He comes to our attention today because of an excellent analysis presented by David Swanson, the author of War is a Lie, and also with RootsAction.org. Welcome back to 5 o'clock shadow, David.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
This is quite a time machine of revelation that you have made in your recent essay, A Forgotten Republican National Committee, about the differences between foreign policy and war-making and the action of Calvin Coolidge to actually have the United States come into the Kellogg-Briand Treaty and other things. Can you give us some background about how that time is like and different from today?
Well, 84 years ago today in Paris, France, the Kellogg-Briand Pact was signed banning war. It is a treaty that is still on the books on the State Department's website. It bans all war, makes it criminal. Of course, it's routinely ignored. But this was a treaty pushed heavily by the United States, by Frank Kellogg, who was Secretary of State for President Calvin Coolidge, in response to a peace movement that was absolutely mainstream, that was driven by the wealthy and the poor, by the newly empowered women voters, by university presidents and lawyers and Republican senators. And it was a movement that hadn't really latched on to one party or another. In fact, by 1924, the Socialist Party, the Progressive Party, the Democratic Party, and incumbent presidential candidate Calvin Coolidge all supported the outlawry of war, that is, the outlawing of war, making war into a crime. It had not been a crime. After World War I, nobody was charged with war. After World War II, they were. And so Calvin Coolidge was president during this time of intense opposition to war, of intense resentment and bitterness about World War I, without yet the flag waving and song singing of World War II. This was this interlude of three Republican candidates, presidents in between Wilson and Roosevelt and the two world wars. And so you had a time when it was possible to talk about arms reduction and peace and the criminalization of war and avoiding war, and have it really be a bipartisan consensus and across the country, overwhelming public opinion. And Calvin Coolidge went with that flow.
You correctly point out that even though the United States is a signatory to the Kellogg-Briand Treaty, that it is routinely ignored. And that brings us to some recent military history of the United States. It has not been since World War II that there has been an actual congressional declaration of war. And all of the other colonial and military interventions are called, like, say, police actions or supporting democracy, clandestine operations. Do you think there's a relationship between this new policy of American war without the declaration of it? Do you think that the treaty has anything to do with that circumlocution?
Well, I think that the Kellogg-Briand Pact changed the acceptability of seizing territory through war, and for the most part, that has been considered illegitimate ever since. I think it reduced war making, and I think that the prosecution, albeit one-sided, the prosecution of the losers of World War II had a significant impact, combined with the additional horrors of World War II piled on top of the horrors of World War I. And so the wealthy nations of the world, who were the primary movers and signers of the Kellogg-Briand Pact, have not gone to war with each other ever since. This is the most remarkable and least noted development of the past 60 years or so. They don't go to war. We only go to war with the poorer nations, with the non-white nations. You know, the idea of doing to a predominantly white country what we do to dark-skinned countries has been taboo for 65 years. But I think that the criminalization of war has indeed led to attempts to redefine war-like actions as non-war, to the point where you have President Obama's lawyer, Harold Coe, telling a Senate committee that the bombing of Libya, which was done actually in contravention of congressional decision, was neither war nor hostilities. These were non-hostile bombs. Because, of course, in the wake of Richard Nixon's war-making, the War Powers Resolution was put through with the language war or hostilities, intending to grab congressional power over anything remotely warlike. But, of course, you can just redefine your words and weasel out of that.
You point out another thing, that is the existence of other parties than the Demublicans, the duopoly of the Democrats and the Republicans, the Socialist Party, the Progressive Party. Can you contrast that with the single party with two wings that we seem to have today?
Well, you had media outlets, newspapers predominantly in that time, that were willing to cover other candidates, other points of view. You had actual party conventions where the outcome was not foreordained, where it remained to be seen who would be the presidential nominee and who would be the vice presidential nominee, and they weren't a ticket. They ended up being paired together at that point. And you had rebellions and schisms within and without the parties, so that you had a progressive wing of the Republican Party threatening to break off. You had the Progressive Party, you had the Socialist Party, and these were major factors in shaping U.S. policy. So you didn't have the situation you have today where you have essentially two very closely aligned parties in a system that has legalized bribery, banned other candidates from debates, made it very difficult for other candidates to get their names on the ballot, gerrymandered every single congressional district to go almost certainly for one party or the other, regardless of candidates. I mean, this is a mockery of democracy, even in comparison with where we were back in the 1920s, where the demand for that treaty banning war was so intense that it was guaranteed to be created in one form or another and to be ratified by the U.S. Senate, because there was still that level of representation, even in the Senate, which has always been miles behind the House. Nowadays, of course, you can have 90% opinion rather strongly on a matter such as taxing billionaires or ending wars, and it means absolutely nothing in Washington.
One of the things that you bring to our attention is the remarkable speech that was given by President Coolidge to the Republican Convention of 1924. His history is not quite as one might expect looking at today's Republicans. For instance, he spoke out forcefully on the issue of civil rights when it was asserted to him that America is a white nation. He also actually decided not to run for a second term, another anomaly. And then later on, he spoke at the inaugural address. Can you bring to our listeners what he said and the significance of the points that he made?
Well, this in 1924, Calvin Coolidge was running for another term. This would be the first term he was elected to, as he had taken over the White House when his predecessor died. But his speech, his speech, like his presidency, was full of regrettable mistakes and backwardness. I don't think we want to make him into a saint. But what is most striking to me, as someone who tries to end wars, is that Calvin Coolidge, in his 1924 acceptance speech of the presidential nomination, not only advocates further reduction of weapons and standing armies and the elimination of this permanent military complex that we now take for granted, but he advocated peace and diplomacy as U.S. policy in specific terms, and really meant it, and advocated the outlawing of war and used that language in response to this grassroots push from this movement to outlaw war. I mean, it's hard for me, and he advocated the, although he, of course, opposed the League of Nations out of this idea that these entanglements are what got us into World War I in the first place. Half the peace movement was with him on that. But he supported joining the permanent court. Nowadays, the idea that either Obama or Romney would so much as hint at the idea of joining the International Criminal Court, or that either of them would support criminalizing and or respecting the criminalization of war that was done in 1928, or ending war, or abolishing standing armies, is ludicrous. Never mind that abolishing standing armies is a required goal of recipients of Nobel Peace Prizes, and even in that speech, our current president went out of his way to praise war. Language in a Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech that struck many as absolutely normal, but would have been jarring to the listeners of Calvin Coolidge's 1924 acceptance speech, wouldn't have fit at all. Here was someone praising peace as a Republican nominee for president.
Well, there is a continuity, as you say, David Swanson, in that Coolidge was a Republican president who complained about taxation and government spending and also wanted to minimize or reduce government agencies and services. And he was complaining about a national budget or debt of about, I think, $7 billion. And nowadays, we are in the deca-trillions of dollars of budget operations, soon to approach a quadrillion. And so there is that continuity. But at the same time, the transition of the Republican Party into such a war-making, aggressive philosophy, is that related to the money that comes in from the munitions makers? How did this 80-year transformation take place within the Republican Party philosophy?
Yeah, I mean, conservatism at the time of Calvin Coolidge actually meant something other than radical right-wing agendas. It meant trying to conserve things, being slow to change, and it was indeed resistance to the development of a military complex. I think a lot was changed in the entire culture and our whole political world by World War II and its aftermath. I think a lot was changed when the parties swapped their roles in terms of which party was going to win the South, which party was going to win the more racist vote. My own state of Virginia up until the last election, when it voted for Barack Obama, had always voted for the more racist candidate, whichever that was. And for a long time, that was the Democrat, and then it became the Republican. And I think, sadly, a lot of these issues go together in our politics and in our demographics. Racism, militarism, opposition to labor rights and civil rights and progressive policies. And so the Republican Party has taken on this role as the more militaristic, the more racist, and so forth. And yet, if all we do as citizens, as so many people advocate now, is pick which party and vote, we're doing our lesser evil choice and getting two candidates the next time around who are both more evil. And so at some point we have to break out of this mold of choosing the less evil candidate and imagining we've accomplished something. But yes, there is that tradition within the Republican Party of libertarianism that included opposition to war and empire. Nowadays, of course, it's usually opposition to everything but wars and empire, which is why we're dumping a majority of discretionary spending into war preparation.
Our guest is David Swanson, the author of War is a Lie, and most recently, the essay A Forgotten RNC. And one of the words that you bring back into the public lexicon is the word outlawry, which was the movement to declare war illegal. And in the current Republican National Committee platform, the title of the document is American Exceptionalism. Can you define that word for us?
Absolutely. I mean, I've written a book called When the World Outlawed War about the peace movement of the 1920s and the Kellogg-Briand Pact, and largely about Coolidge's presidency. And it's at davidswanson.org/outlawry. Outlaw, R-Y on the end. That was the name of the movement. And it was not completely at odds with American exceptionalism, this idea that America is special and different and there should be a double standard in terms of the rules and laws applied, is a standard of racism and nationalistic bigotry that can take on many, many shades from genocidal to humanitarian. We would never do to our own country what we do to places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and Syria, whether we're claiming it's for their own good or claiming that it's necessary to wipe those evil creatures off the face of the earth. And even as the Kellogg-Briand Pact was put in place banning war, the Monroe Doctrine was upheld, the idea that Latin America was subject to our dictates. In fact, colonialism was upheld, the idea that you could threaten nations with war and suppress them because they weren't quite up to your standards and had a different skin color, remained in place despite the banning of war among the powerful war-making countries. And that, of course, has remained the case right up through today, and is openly advocated with no shame in things like the Republican Party platform.
David Swanson, the Republican platform is calling for more military spending, a reversal of the slowing of the rate of increase of Pentagon spending, and for extraordinary powers around the world for the president to intervene militarily, and so on. And yet, the sitting president, Barack Obama of the Democratic Party, has been doing exactly these things. Can you contrast the idea that a person of peace is forced to choose between a Democrat or a Republican?
Well, the problem is that even if you can squint and see a difference, as most people can, just making that vote is not going to change things in this country. It's, we're with this imagination that somehow women voted themselves the right to vote and the civil rights movement dropped all the sit-ins and marches and endorsed Democrats and the labor movement was created by dumping people's hard-earned pay into Democratic campaigns. I mean, it's all nonsense. It's all out of out of whack with the centuries of history, and yet it's this very common assumption today that the only thing you can do is endorse candidates. We have a holiday for Martin Luther King Jr. despite him never endorsing candidates and therefore not being a serious activist by this definition, which strikes me as ludicrous. The way that we change things is to educate and organize and mobilize and fix the entire culture. As in 1924, four parties, not one, had been brought around to the idea of banning war by public pressure on the culture as a whole. That tends to be the way it works. We are unlikely to reform one party while allowing the other to continue down its path into the abyss. We have an incumbent who has legitimized and codified imprisonment without trial, assassination, has a list of people to murder, and he goes through every Tuesday and checks off who's to be murdered next, and so forth, and whose whole campaign platform is his willingness to compromise, his willingness to slash Social Security and Medicaid and so forth. Well, if we self-censor and endorse that wholeheartedly, we're licensing that party to get worse and worse and worse as long as the other party stays out ahead of it as worse yet. That's not how we're going to save ourselves. So, you know, regardless of how you're going to vote in that moment in the voting booth, don't be an advocate for half of a corrupt government the rest of the year. Do your job as a citizen. Look back at what actually changed things in past decades and contribute something more than being a voter.
David Swanson, I'd like to thank you for bringing us a great historical revelation with the Forgotten RNC and your book, War is a Lie, and your writings at davidswanson.org. Why don't you tell us what you are up to and how people can follow you?
Well, davidswanson.org is my website. It has a number of my books there, including When the World Outlawed War, about this period in the 20s. But I spend a lot of my time at rootsaction.org, where I am a campaign coordinator.
Well, thank you once again, David Swanson. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Delegates and alternates, please give a warm welcome to the chairman of the Republican National Committee, Reince Priebus of Wisconsin.
Thank you. Thank you. Wow. Thank you. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, by the authority contained in the rules adopted by the 2008 Republican National Convention, the Republican National Committee has directed that the 2012 Republican National Convention be held in Tampa, Florida, starting at 2 o'clock p.m. on the 27th day of August, 2012. So it is my privilege to proclaim the 2012 Republican National Convention in session and called to order. The chair announces, pursuant to Clause 12, paren B, paren 1 of Rule 1 of the Rules of the House of Representatives, the 2012 Republican National Convention stands in recess, subject to the call of the chair. All right.
The secret GOP plan to buy, steal, and rig the election is becoming more clear.
Voter suppression. Don't block the vote. To stop Barack Obama and turn back the clock, the far right have created a congressional gridlock. We cannot and we will not be taken back to Jim Crow before the 1964 Voting Rights Act. Conservative incompetence is a political bloodhound, but we ain't gonna let nobody turn us around.
You can pray until you faint, but if you don't get up and try to do something, God is not gonna put it in your lap.
In the name of their good old boy hypocrisy, they'll stop at nothing to steal the presidency. They never fail to scheme, plot, and plan so right-wing battleground states gain the upper hand. But we won't be denied our political discretion by what they refuse to call voter suppression.
Politico reports the billionaire conservative Koch brothers plan to spend $200 million on the 2012 election.
They're not in favor of nothing that would promote making it easier for the disenfranchised to vote.
This is just a new way to stop people from voting.
No more early voting, no more Soul Sunday registration, all because of a bureaucratic maze of intimidation. You can't vote without a state-issued photo ID in some states, in this so-called land.
Not gonna get in the mess, because if you vote
and rig the election is becoming more clear.
In 08, they defied their own right to be wrong when the black vote was too black and too strong. Conservative incompetence is a political bloodhound, but we ain't gonna let nobody turn us around.
This is just a new way to stop people from voting.
For we won't be denied our political discretion by what they refuse to call voter suppression.
And there's no need of running and no need of stands. Honey, I'm not gonna get in the mess. Because if you are born in America with a black face, you're born in the mess.
This is just a new way to stop people from voting.
You can pray until you faint, but if you don't get up and try to do something, God is not gonna put it in your lap.
Voter suppression.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and that was Voter Suppression, performed by Daniel R. Queen of the website queenspalaceinc.com. And before that, the opening of today's first session of the Republican National Convention in Tampa, Florida, where the only thing moving to the left is Hurricane Isaac. And the idea of voter suppression is also a matter of concern, apparently, among delegates of Ron Paul. The Ron Paul website earlier today put up a notice, an alert, that all delegates should show up, even though the convention was gaveled in and immediately recessed. Ron Paul also spoke over the weekend and has yet to endorse the Romney candidacy for the presidency of the United States. To help understand the role and influence, or lack thereof, of Ron Paul in the Republican Party, we're very happy to be joined now by Ivan Eland of the Independent Institute. Welcome to the Shadow, Ivan.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, what is up with Ron Paul? Is he going to be a player, or will he be subverted?
Well, I think he's reached the conclusion that he's trying to do what is best for his movement in the long run. And you can argue whether he's doing that or not, but I think he's chosen to not make a fuss. He's not thoroughly endorsing Romney, and he wasn't asked to speak. His son, who is more establishment-oriented than he is, although he's still a libertarian, he's been asked to speak, and, you know, he has endorsed Romney. But as far as I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to be a guerrilla movement like, you know, the conservatives were in the Republican Party for years, and then they eventually got the Goldwater nomination in 64, and then it took them another, 16 years before they got a nomination for president, and then they got elected with Ronald Reagan. So I think that's sort of the strategy, work within the party to see if they can, you know, eventually take it over. Who knows if they'll be successful with that strategy, but that seems to be sort of an inside strategy rather than an outside strategy.
Ron Paul, as an independent, has been frequently characterized as a libertarian. but that comes not without some conservative tendencies. Can you define what is meant in the current use of the term libertarian?
Well, it's just liberals tend to be, socially, they don't want the government in their business. Economically, they do. And conservatives are kind of the reverse. They want the government out of the economic sphere, but they don't mind a lot of government involvement in the social sphere. So I think a libertarian is sort of wants less government involvement in all spheres, including foreign policy. And you saw Ron Paul was the most anti-war of all the candidates in both parties. This time and last election as well.
The base of Ron Paul is very highly motivated, apparently. And to what do you attribute that?
Well, I think Ron Paul actually is a very principled person for a member of Congress, because many members of Congress sort of play the political winds and what's going on, and that's at the moment. And he doesn't do that. And you can agree with him or disagree with him. But most people in Congress, I think, would tell you that Ron Paul pretty much votes his conscience all the time, and he seems to have made it work in a conservative district in Texas. So, and that included, some votes against the Iraq War and that sort of thing. So, but the reason people are revved up about him is he does have a sense of personal integrity, and he is very consistent. And, of course, libertarians are very consistent in their views about small government as well. They, as I mentioned, they believe in less government in all spheres. So I think that's what drives the people. And I think, he's doubled his performance since the last election. So his movement is growing. So he really never intended to win. I don't think he wants to raise issues and raise a perspective and hopefully continue his movement down the road here. He has an heir apparent now that his son is a senator.
Yes, Rand Paul, that would be.
Right.
Ivan Eland of the Independent Institute is also the author of Recarving Rushmore, Ranking the Presidents on Peace, Prosperity, and Liberty. And one of the tokens of the Ron Paul campaign makes use of the chemical accident of the two middle letters of his name, AU, and he's asserting a return to the gold standard for the United States economy and, of course, an abolition of the Federal Reserve Bank, which is actually very much a privatized institution. Can you give us some idea of what kind of economic policy might be expected under the Ron Paul philosophy, and what would that mean for the least well-off in America?
Well, people on the left tend to, when you say free market, they tend to think big businessman oppression and that sort of thing. But Ron Paul, when he means free market, he's not for business subsidies or business collusion with government. And many big corporations don't support Ron Paul because they think he's too a radical free marketeer. And when you have the market, you have a lot of competition, and the market regulates a lot of things. But the market sometimes doesn't work in our country because the government goes in and makes a sweet deal for big companies. And, of course, the bigger your company, the more lawyers you have. So the more regulation actually helps big companies, and it forces out smaller businesses that can't compete. So Ron Paul is not pro-business, he's pro-market, and there's a big difference there. And many people don't, not only on the left, but all over the political spectrum, they don't realize that there's a big difference there. So he's against, for instance, agricultural subsidies, business subsidies to, say, oil companies, that sort of thing. But he also believes that we shouldn't have excess regulations and that sort of thing. Now, on the gold standard, he believes that the Federal Reserve has, over the course of it, it's only been in existence. We think of the Federal Reserve as having been there forever, but it's really central banking in the United States has really been around only since 1913. For much of our history, we didn't have a central bank. There were periodic attempts to have one, and everybody always beat it back because they realized that these central banks, and the Fed is no exception, is really a subsidy to big banks, and it always has been. And also, its regulation of the economy hasn't been very good, as we've seen in the mortgage crisis, and other times in U.S. history as well. The Great Depression, it's no coincidence that the Great Depression started, you know, not 20 years after the Fed was created, actually less than 20 years. So he has a problem with the Fed, and the gold standard is what we did for most of our history. It's become kind of out of fashion now, but it prevents a lot of inflation, and it's very predictable, so everybody has an idea of what's going on in the economy. We don't now with the Fed. We have to determine these bankers who may or may not have our interests at heart, determining interest rates and that sort of thing in the smoke-filled room, and that's what the Fed still does. They issue these cryptic statements, which everybody tries to read, and so he is he's very much into going back to the traditional way of banking in the United States, which was a lot of smaller banks and that sort of thing. You might have big banks nowadays with new technology, but certainly you wouldn't have the collusion between the government and the big banks that we have, and that was in part caused by the mortgage crisis. What happened there was they basically tell big banks that they're too big to fail. Well, what do you do if you're too big to fail? You go out and make a lot of risky loans because you can make a lot of money, and if you lose money on them, which is the traditional market way of punishing people, they do stupid things. But, of course, if the government says, well, you're too big to fail, and the banks know that, then there's no downside risk of making really risky loans, which is what they went out and did. And we're going to continue to have these banking crises if we don't reform the banking system. And I think he's absolutely right on that score.
Final question for you today, Ivan Eland, and that is the major one. The philosophy of Ron Paul is sometimes favored by people of the left in some circumstances in regard to the peace movement, in regard to ending the expensive, deadly, and oppressive military actions abroad of the United States. Do you think that Ron Paul has a snowball's chance in hell of imprinting that onto the Republican Party platform or philosophy or campaign?
Not this year, I don't think. In fact, I think Romney's advisors are very hawkish neoconservatives, and they're probably more hawkish than the advisors that Obama has. So I don't think this time. But I think, you know, we've had these expensive wars which have racked up debt, casualties, both American and people from other countries. And, you know, our foreign policy, as Ron Paul says, perhaps somebody ought to look at our foreign policy to see what caused 9/11 in the first place. And I think that's about, we've never had that discussion. He's very courageous for having brought it up. So I think there's hope for this. There's more hope for that restrained, going back to the founders, restrained military policy. And that's really what Ron Paul is trying to do, is get us back to more traditional way of looking things, both economically and in foreign policy, how the country was built. We stayed out of a lot of foreign activities, wars, and we didn't really get involved in anything big until World War I. And, of course, that's when things started to go downhill. Well, the Depression was an outgrowth of World War I. And, of course, World War II was an outgrowth of the Depression. And, you know, now we have the massive unresponsive government, which you know, tends to oppress a lot of different people in different ways. So I think he's basically trying to get back to the original American conception of restrained foreign policy. And I think over time that may be, I don't think we're going to, he's already had some effect, and so have the wars. I think Obama so far has been reluctant to get into the Syrian thing, and hopefully that will continue. But and I think people are certainly sick of long ground wars like Afghanistan and Iraq. So I think it has the most potential for taking hold in the last, you know, since the Vietnam War ended, I think. Maybe the neoconservatives will be humbled by this. I don't count on it. But I just think they're probably not going to get the resonance that they used to. So I think Ron Paul is having an effect on the debate. And these things take time, and I think our budget situation is also going to you know, impact on this, because we just don't have time to, or, you know, the money or the time anymore to waste our energies on these wars which are in faraway places which don't really affect U.S. security.
Well, I'd like to thank you for joining us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow, Ivan Eland, Senior Fellow at the Independent Institute and author of Recarving Rushmore, Ranking the Presidents on Peace, Prosperity, and Liberty, as well as The Empire Has No Clothes, U.S. Foreign Policy Exposed. And your organization is at the website independent.org. Any other notes for people to follow you?
Just that my Recarving Rushmore book looks at the presidents, how the founders would have evaluated the presidents. And I discuss, you know, where we went askew in my ratings and that sort of thing. That's the only thing I add. And I hope that, you know, Ron Paul does have an effect on the election.
Well, thank you once again, Ivan Eland of the Independent Institute. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. And we now go to the horse's mouth with the speech of Ron Paul given over this weekend at the Sun Dome in Tampa, Florida.
Oh, this is wonderful. It's wonderful to be among friends with my family, and for a good reason, to promote the cause of liberty in a revolutionary spirit. Thank you very much for being here. I have to tell you, though, I was pretty worried the early part of this week. Saw a couple of bad articles. I saw it wasn't the hurricane that I was worried about, but I saw that it said, revolution is over. There's going to be no revolution. Major paper in Washington, D.C., they said, the revolution will not be happening. Don't they only wish? But it is so great to come together for something so important. You know, a lot of people say today is a very important day, and I think it is. Our events today, to me, very important. And they say that this convention is very important this week, and indeed it is. And this election is very important. But let me tell you, there's something even more important than all that, and that is the cause that we're leading and the cause of liberty, the attention that we're getting right now. There's been a lot of talk about whether or not I would get to speak at the convention. And, of course, I've written that off. But today, I was very excited. I got a call from the RNC. And they said they changed their mind. And they're going to give me a whole hour. I can say anything I want. Tomorrow night. Just kidding. First off, I really want to recognize our delegates, hundreds. I don't know how many, but thank you. It takes a lot of hard work, and you knew the rules better than they thought they knew the rules. But, you know, that didn't stop them. They've learned how to bend rules, break rules, and now they want to rewrite the rules. But then again, maybe they've been paying attention to what's been going on in Washington. They've been bending the rules and breaking the rules and rewriting the rules for too long. That's what we have to stop from happening. You know, people at the convention were worried just how much trouble we would cause, and you generally have known what my advice is. Just stopping something for the sake of stopping it doesn't achieve a whole lot, so I've been a little bit cautious. But what they have found out is they've overstepped the bound. There's a big fight going on. and we're involved in it, but everybody else, a bunch of them, are joining us and saying, you've gone too far. The Ron Paul people were right about overstepping their bounds. Well, it's just been great, the experience I've had these last 5 years, and it's been a very important time, not only for me personally, but I think for the attention that we're getting. Now, I've received a lot of compliments about it and given some credit about it, but I tell you what, it takes you, it takes a lot of other people, there's been a lot of things going on for decades, and it's coming about. It's coming about. Not so much, not only because I believe we're right on the issues, but what is coming out right now is proof positive that their philosophy of government, whether it's foreign policy, monetary policy, or economic policy, is failing, and they need something different. I have often quoted, Victor Hugo about Samuel Adams about an irate Taoist minority, and bringing about changes in that way. But ultimately, that minority is irate and tireless, and they, light the fires of liberty in the minds of men. Yes, that's important. But ultimately, numbers do count, and even numbers do count when they don't count all the votes as well. Because we do have the numbers. But those who promote ideas ultimately have to have an influence on the prevailing attitudes of the people. And that is what's happening today. The people now are waking up and they're realizing the failure of what we have and the reason that these ideas are coming about. Now, in this primary, we had close to 2 million votes. They said, oh, yeah, there's 2 million votes. That doesn't swing an election, da-da-da. It's no big deal. But guess what? For every vote that we got in the primary, let me tell you, just from my personal experience of traveling around the country and meeting people at airports and wherever, the support out there is much, much greater, and they don't feel comfortable coming to a Republican primary. So the support there, I would say, be 2 or 3 times as much as the number of votes we got in the primary. We have talked a lot about the excitement that the young people bring, the excitement we've had on the campuses. I asked somebody on the staff after the last campaign event on a college campus, I said, how many campuses did I go to? And let me tell you, if they had told me I was going to go to this number of campuses during the campaign, I probably would have said, there's no way you could do that. We went to 33 college campuses. Talked to close to 150,000 young people, enthusiastic. Were they the conservative college campuses, or were they the liberal college campuses? No, they were all the college campuses. They welcomed us. Now, when you think, if there's a party that says, oh, we have an open tent, we want new people to come in, we want to appeal to the young people, don't you think they would be begging and pleading that they come into the big tent? Well, we'll get into the tent, believe me, because we will become the tent eventually. Once they know we are the future, they will know about this. But the young people certainly have the enthusiasm. And I think it's the enthusiasm that really energizes a campaign. It energizes not only themselves and the college campuses, and I've always maintained there will not be a true revolution unless the college campuses are alive and well with those ideas. But there has been so many times that the young people, not only those of voting age, but sometimes 13 and 14 and 15, they bring their parents to the office and have them converted into believing and understanding about what liberty is all about. Young people energize a lot of other people and give the energy to the remnant who are with us already. So this to me is exciting with the energy that we have. It seems to me that they would be begging and pleading for us to come into the party.
Texas Representative Ron Paul. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow, and that concludes today's program, which was produced by Thiago Brozo and engineered by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your comments, tips, leaks, questions, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.